Okay. I didn't know, I did guest lectures up here. But be that as it may, we are going today to look at Wittgenstein's reflections on aesthetic matters, and I carefully not say Wittgenstein's aesthetics, because he didn't produce any aesthetics of any particular sort. Neither did he write anything which might be considered aesthetical contribution or a contribution to the philosophy of art in any ordinary sense. But you know, of course, that he did on two occasions give lectures on aesthetic matters. And he was very much occupied with art. Art, especially music, was extremely important to Wittgenstein. He often talked about how a particular piece of music had made a deep impression on him. Quite a few of his friends, as well as some of his students, tell us about this side of his character. One of his students, Maurice O.C. Drury, expresses his experience of this kind in the following way. To watch Wittgenstein listening to music was to realize that this was something very central and deep in his life. He told me that this he could not express in his writings. And yet, it was so important to him that he felt that without it, he was sure to be misunderstood. I will never forget the emphasis with which he quoted Schopenhauer's dictum, "Music is a world in itself." Unquote. This conversation with Drury refers, the conversation Drury refers to, took place assumably in the summer of 1934. In passing, two points are worth noting in this quotation. A, according to Wittgenstein, the meaning and depth of the musical experience is inexpressible by verbal means. And B, Wittgenstein makes use of a central dictum from Schopenhauer's Aesthetics to articulate this inexpressibility. You will understand why that is important when I end my lecture today. It was not, however, only in the field of music that Wittgenstein's aesthetical interests manifested themselves. He also took a great interest in various forms of literature, especially those which managed to convey a moral message in an indirect way. Two examples he often mentioned in this respect were Tolstoy's story, Hajik Murat, and Heinrich von Kleist's Mikhail Kolas. Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and Ibsen were among his absolute favorites in the foreign literature. In German, he repeatedly read Goethe, Schiller, Mörike, Lessing, of the Swiss author Gottfried Keller. His taste in this field, as in music, was classic in orientation. But among the modern German poets, he in fact took pleasure in reading Rilke and Trakl. And those of you who know these poets will know that they are not very easy to understand. Well, Wittgenstein also practiced some arts. He learned to play the clarinet when he educated himself as a school teacher. His parents tried to make him play the piano, but then he was instructed in a traditional way, and he hated that, so he stopped doing that. And he even tried himself a little in sculpture, and he acted as an architect when he designed and had built his sister Margarete, or Gretel in the family's house. But in the last project he had good help from his friend who was an architect, Paul Engelmann. The Wittgenstein family, as you hopefully know, was a very central factor in the cultural life of Vienna at the time when Wittgenstein was a boy. And his sister, Gretel, was the one who was closest to Wittgenstein when it came to matters of culture, art, and philosophy. When Wittgenstein was at the Realschule in Linz, then he was between 14 and 16 years old, he discovered that he in fact had no Christian belief in the traditional sense. He talked about this to Gretel, and she encouraged him to start reading Schopenhauer, who among other things states that, quote, "It is neither necessary nor possible for an intelligent, honest man to believe in the literal truth of religious doctrines," unquote. He was not quite on religion, as you gather from this. It was also Gretel, or through her, that Wittgenstein first became aware of this impressive figure in Vienna at that time, Karl Kraus. Kraus started his satirical journal Die Fackel, The Torch, in 1899. He was a social democrat who attacked any aspect of the Austrian society where hypocrisy and lack of integrity could be spotted. That included the laissez-faire economic policy which Wittgenstein's father, Karl Wittgenstein, advocated in his in the leading Vienna Viennese newspaper Neue Freie Presse. It also included what Kraus called the corruption of the Viennese press in its willingness to serve the interests of the government and of big business. And Karl Wittgenstein was at the top of big business in Austria at that time. So one of his children, Gretel, undermining his position by interest in this. And she also took interest in socialism, which was outrageous in the Wittgenstein family. Okay, that was just a short sketch to locate our hero here. Then the important question is, what about aesthetics in the Tractatus period? And now we are all aware that Wittgenstein, as a very young man, read Schopenhauer, and in one of Schopenhauer's works, Die Welt als Wille und Vorstellung, you find a very big chapter on aesthetics, which Wittgenstein took a great interest in. Well, what do we find if we look at the published works in the Tractatus period concerning aesthetics? Well, there is no such thing in what he published, and he published only a book review and Tractatus. So it's very easy to check. But why is it that he did not publish anything in aesthetics? That is the central question. And that has to do with what he thought he had to do to clarify things at that time. You know, since you have had a lecture on Tractatus, that all cognitively meaningful sentences are sentences presenting possible or actual facts. All other kinds of sentences are not cognitively meaningful. But when it comes to religion, ethics, and aesthetics, they are values. And values are not facts. They are not in the world, as the world is the totality of facts. Wittgenstein says that the sense of the world must lie outside the world. And he goes on, if there is any value that does have value, it must lie outside the whole sphere of what happens and is the case. For all that happens and is the case is accidental. Hence, there can be no propositions of ethics or aesthetics. Values are thus necessarily outside the world. And in the same paragraphs, he further says that, quote, it is clear that ethics cannot be put into words. Ethics is transcendental, unquote. And he parenthetically adds that, quote, ethics and aesthetics are one and the same, unquote. This has, of course, the logical consequence that also aesthetics is transcendental. And that means that ethics and aesthetics are thus inexpressible in words. And that's a fairly good reason for not put anything of aesthetics and ethics in Tractatus. But these remarks at the end of Tractatus, the logical positivists, for instance, they regarded them as something this eccentric fellow Wittgenstein put in there. The main part is the logical part. That was not quite trial. But let us drop that and look at the lecture of on ethics that he gave sometime in 1929, when he just had returned to philosophy after having been away from it for more than 10 years. In this lecture, he returns to the question of values, and he presents his audience with a distinction between absolute and relative value. The word good, in the relative sense, he says, simply means, quote, coming up to a predetermined standard. But this is, of course, not the good in an ethical judgment. To present the difference, he gives the following example. Quote, suppose that I could play tennis and one of you saw me play and said, well, you play pretty badly. And suppose I answered, I know I'm playing badly, but I don't want to play any better. All the other man could say would be, ah, then that's all right. But suppose I had told one of you a preposterous lie, and he came up to me and said, you are behaving like a beast. And then I were to say, I know I behaved badly, but I don't want to behave any better. Could he then say, ah, then that's all right? Certainly not. He would say, well, you ought to want to behave better. Here you have an absolute judgment of value. As human beings, we have in this case no choice, is the message. We are under an obligation to try to behave better. Wittgenstein was to soften this distinction later on, but even in the 1938 lectures on aesthetics, it is clear that we cannot express what he calls the tremendous things in art, in words. Thus, there is little, very little to say about Wittgenstein's aesthetics or Wittgenstein's view on aesthetic matters in the Tractatus period, if we stick to the published writings only. But that is not the whole story, since you probably know that Wittgenstein's also left behind him some diaries called notebooks, 1940-1960, which were published well, almost 20 years after he had died, and he wanted them destroyed, but his sisters didn't do that. And in these notebooks we find some remarks concerning aesthetic matters, which I shall just present to you without attempting to make them hang together, because that is quite a job, and I've done that elsewhere, and it would take at least 2 hours to present the whole story. But we also have to know that these notes was a mixture of something which was a preparation for writing Tractatus and private notes. So that was why probably Wittgenstein didn't want them published. They are therefore often expressed in an oracular manner, or they presuppose a kind of context which Wittgenstein alone was fully aware of. Reading these remarks many years later, we are doomed to guessing and speculation. But at least some people have sat down and done that kind of guessing and speculation, and I am one of them. Well, in the notes from September 19th, 1916, and it is only the last half year he starts talking about aesthetics. That's interesting too. The first 1.5 years is logic and logic only, on some remarks on religion in between, etc. Well, at this September day, he says that, quote, "Art is a kind of expression. Good art is complete expression," unquote. And in the next entry, which is quite a jump to October the 7th, he comments upon the relation between art and ethics, which are in Tractatus said to be one and the same. He says the following, quote, "The work of art is the object seen sub specie aeternitatis, and the good life is the world seen sub specie aeternitatis. This is the connection between art and aesthetics," unquote. To view something sub specie aeternitatis, this is a Latin expression stolen from Spinoza, is to view them from the point of view of eternity. And the point of view of eternity, in Wittgenstein's terminology, is timelessness. The point of view of eternity can, however, only be adopted by one who lives in the present. And to live in the present means to live without any care about the past or the future. It means to be totally absorbed by what you are, or what you are up to or involved in. To live this way is to live in agreement with the world, he says, in fact, in Tractatus and in the notebooks. And living this way, you experience neither fear nor hope. It is to live a happy life, Wittgenstein says. Accordingly, quote, "The essence of the artistic way of looking at things is that it looks at the world with a happy eye," unquote. And the following day, the 8th of October then, he notes that, quote, "There is certainly something in the conception that the end of art is the beautiful. And the beautiful is what makes happy," unquote. Consequently, the imaginative adoption of the point of view from eternity when confronting a successful or successful work of art, which is a complete expression, is, in the young Wittgenstein's opinion, a road to happiness. Quite interesting. That is due to the kind of experience one may have when the point of view from eternity is applied. In the appreciation of an excellent work of art, one, according to Wittgenstein, undergoes an experience of wonder at the existence of the object, a mystical experience of absolute value, in which the wonderfulness of the object is made manifest to one. This is a rough picture of the young Wittgenstein's thinking about art and aesthetic experience. And it is incomplete in several ways. Most importantly, I have left out the kind of mysticism which we find in connection with the concept of value in Tractatus and in the notebooks. And this mysticism no doubt formed the basis of the young Wittgenstein's attitude to human life. And the way Wittgenstein makes use of elements from Schopenhauer's aesthetics, presented in the will, in the world as will and representation, is also significant and most interesting. But there is not enough time for me to go into that here and now. In the pause, I can give you some literature if you are interested in that. Let us then jump ahead to the middle and the later Wittgenstein, because in this period at least he lectured on aesthetic matters on two occasions. And for those of you who have read, for instance, Philosophical Investigations, you know that he touches upon aesthetic matters here and there, and he even uses examples from the aesthetic field to illustrate points in the philosophy of language. But Philosophical Investigations was a very powerful book, and after it was published in 1953, quite a lot of persons interested in aesthetics were to read it, and in fact we might say that it formed a kind of Wittgensteinian tradition in philosophy of art or aesthetics after the Second World War. A number of the most reputed philosophers of art from this period, Cyril Barrett, Stanley Cavell, Ben Tillman, Moritz Weitz, etc., were significantly influenced by Wittgenstein. And this influence was sufficiently strong to start talking about the Wittgenstein tradition in philosophy of art or aesthetics. But there's a strange thing about these guys who sit down and use Wittgenstein to handle problems in aesthetics or in philosophy of art. It is not Wittgenstein's own reflections on aesthetic matters that stand center stage in their works. His own voice has only to a modest degree been heard in these investigations. They preferred to take a concept from Wittgenstein, for instance, a family resemblance, and apply it on, for instance, the work of art, as Moritz Weitz did, and he wrote in 1955 a very famous article, The Role of Theory in Aesthetics, and more or less paralyzed field for 6, 7, 8 years. But if they had wanted to delve into Wittgenstein's thinking on aesthetic matters, they could have looked at some of the stuff that had, for instance, in the 80s already been published. Georg Henrik von Wright published perhaps the most influential book in that respect. It's called Vermischte Bemerkungen, in English, Peter Winch's translation. It's called Culture and Value. That's quite a lot of remarks concerning culture and art and aesthetics and philosophy and a lot of other things, but there's quite a lot on art. And from conversations with friends and letters written to them by Wittgenstein, we also could find relevant things if we tried to see what Wittgenstein himself has to say on aesthetic matters. We could look into Philosophische Grammatik, we could look into Philosophische Untersuchungen, we could look into the blue and brown books and Zettel, and even the remarks on the foundations of mathematics contain some relevant stuff here. So, any person intent of giving Wittgenstein's own opinion a hearing in the philosophy of art is therefore not short of material. But very few have tried to do so. If one wants, however, to form a picture of Wittgenstein's own thinking about aesthetic matters, this is a rather unfortunate procedure. So in the following, I promise to stick to what Wittgenstein himself has to say in several sources on this question. And the first thing we have to is to see how he handles the known aesthetics, because he uses this term in at least 5 different senses, and I shall spell that out to you now. The first of the senses is a most uncommon one, and that is the sense which I have already sketched to you. Here we find it in the notebooks, 1940-1916, because here aesthetics refers to what I just described as a certain kind of imaginative adoption of a view from eternity. It is a matter of assuming a particular attitude towards a certain kind of objects in the world, namely works of art. And we don't hear anything more of this sense of aesthetics later in his writings. The second sense of the term we find in the opening remark of the 1938 lectures. There he says, the subject, and Cyril Barrett has added aesthetics, is very big and completely misunderstood as far as I can see. Unquote. And that's quite an opening for a lecture. Here, it is natural to assume that he is referring to the philosophical discipline aesthetics as traditionally practiced. It is aesthetics in this sense that is subject to rather severe criticism in the following lectures that he gave in the summer of 1938. But after this bang opening, he goes on to describe in the first lecture his own way of approaching philosophical problems by contrasting it with what that of contemporary philosophers do. Here make a remark to the effect that, quote, if I had to say what is the main mistake made by philosophers of the present generation, including Moore, I would say that it is that when language is looked at, what is looked at is a form of words and not the use made of the form of words. End quote. That is paragraph 5 in the first lecture. As language is a characteristic part of a huge group of human activities, it is more to the point to concentrate on the occasion on which these forms of words are used. And Wittgenstein puts his own strategy like this. We don't start from words, but from certain occasions. End quote. The aim of this approach, he says, is to be able to give what he calls grammatical explanations. And that, he says, in lecture 2, paragraph 18. And these grammatical explanations, they are done in, they're given in order to dissolve the problems. This is, as you obviously understand, a fairly early description of the method he makes use of in philosophical investigations. He had already written the first draft of those paragraphs, but he reworked quite a lot, quite a few of them later on. Well, the fourth sense of aesthetics is found in connection with Wittgenstein's discussion of the idea of conceiving aesthetics as a kind of science. An exceedingly stupid idea, Wittgenstein's comment in lecture 2. But it did exist and it had to be commented upon. For instance, this kind of aesthetics is represented by the former editor of the Journal of Aesthetics and Art Criticism, Thomas Munro, long after Wittgenstein's lectures in 38 were given. You could just look at Munro's collection of essays towards the science of in aesthetics. Wittgenstein spends quite some time arguing against this scientistic way of conceiving aesthetics. It was an idea in vogue in the first half of the 20th century, inspired by the then rather newly developed experimental psychology. And the nice little point, Wittgenstein himself was in fact hooked by this idea in his youth. He conducted a series of experiments on the experience of rhythm in music in 1911. So what he says in 38 is a kind of self-criticism as well. Exceedingly stupid idea. But he did it. Okay, before we have a break, I can give you the last and fifth sense of aesthetics. That is present in the whole of Wittgenstein's later philosophy. In the published writings of Wittgenstein, it is first introduced in the 1933 lecture. He makes there what looks like a quite general remark on the nature of aesthetics. He says that, quote, "What aesthetics tries to do is to give reasons, exemplia gratia, for having this word rather than that in a particular place in a poem, or for having this musical phrase rather than that in a particular place in a piece of music," unquote. This is taken from the transcript of this lecture by George Edward Moore. You find it there. And this, to put it mildly, is a far cry from the kind of thing one can reasonably be said to do, or which one is supposed to do when practicing philosophical aesthetics. Nevertheless, Wittgenstein used the term aesthetics from time to time in this particular sense. In a manuscript, which is in the Nachlass, 156a from the period which this lecture were given, 32-34, Wittgenstein comments upon something which he calls an aesthetic instruction, aesthetischer Unterricht, which consists in showing someone the sketch of a master and how he later modified it. And just a few lines later, he observes that, quote, "The aesthetic criticism of a work of art," aesthetische Kritik is the German, "draws our attention to certain features. By comparing the work with others, describing it in terms of comparisons to other processes, etc., it says something like, pay attention to this climax," unquote. And here I think we have to take a break.